Larry, let's start with Tucker Carlson's interview with Putin. For almost 30 minutes, he was
Yeah.
talking about the history of Russia. In your opinion, what was the importance of this?
Well, he was trying to make it clear to people in the West that Russia's concern and involvement in Ukraine is not something that started in the last decade or last 20 years. It didn't even start 100 years ago. Didn't start 200 years ago. Started 1,200 years ago at least. So, just, that's a concept that many people, particularly in America, have trouble understanding. You know, we're like so the Alzheimer's country, and what better leader to have than Joe Biden to represent the Alzheimer's country? You know, can't remember anything, much less history. It's like that song from the 1950s, early 1960s. Don't know much about history. Don't know much about biology. We don't know much. Well, that's why Putin was talking about it, because the emergence of Russia and the Novorossiya, as he referred to it, the Crimea area, this is long embedded in Russian history, and they remember. They haven't forgotten.
He said that they were building up the relationships with the United States. At the same time, the US and its satellites, that he's talking about the European Union, were helping separatism and terrorist groups in Caucasus. If they were cooperating in Iraq, what was the necessity of doing that in Caucasus?
Well, because the goal of the West is to take and steal the resources of Russia. They want them all for themselves. The gold, the oil, the uranium, the gas, the nickel, the nitrogen. You know, Russia has a vast, vast mineral resources, and the West wants them. And they want to take them. So this is this is the equivalent of rape, only it's economic rape. But the United States is going to take it by force and consume it for itself without regards to what it does to the Russian people.
Because when you look at this type of behavior, you see the same thing right now happening between United States and China. At the same time, they have conflict considering Japan, considering Taiwan. They're asking China to help them in the Red Sea. You know, it's so bizarre when you look at this type of
Yeah.
behavior.
You know, to quote Ronald Reagan, there you go again, being rational and logical, Nima. What's wrong with you? You're supposed to be irrational, illogical. Yeah, this would be as funny as a Monty Python skit, were not the fact that actually there are lives of people involved that are dying. And the United States is causing enormous damage and mayhem throughout the Middle East. But that the United States in one breath proclaims China as an enemy and then has the balls to go to the Chinese and say, oh, would you help us out here in the Red Sea and get these Houthis to behave themselves? You know, the Chinese look at us like, oh, us help you? You know, why? So you can take more advantage of us? There is a concept in many countries outside of the United States, particularly in China, which is called respect, saving face, not disrespecting, not humiliating. And the United States doesn't understand that. Most Americans are clueless when it comes to that. So we have a unique talent to go disrespect and piss people off. And then we wonder why don't they like us? just because we killed a bunch of their family members. I mean, God, that's a bit, why are they being so unreasonable? Oh, Lord. It's sad.
The other thing that Putin mentioned in this interview was the CIA declaring that they're helping oppositions in Russia. So, if they're doing this, why they need to do that?
Well, they started doing it. This is not new. When right after World War II, you had the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, that later became the CIA. And the OSS at that time had contacts with Ukrainians, particularly Ukrainians connected to the Bandera forces, which had fought alongside the Nazis and had formed their own SS Galicia unit that was, wound up fighting Russians. That's just as an aside. That's why when that one former SS Nazi Ukrainian showed up in the Canadian Parliament, that they described to me, in World War II, he fought the Russians. And they're just banking on people being flat out ignorant of history, because remember World War II? The Russians were fighting the Nazis. So ergo, by definition, this guy is a Nazi. So the United States, once the CIA was up and running, began putting a lot of money into Bandera units and guerrilla units in Ukraine, and forced the then Soviet Union to fight a pretty aggressive counterinsurgency campaign for about 7 or 8 years. I think it was finally sort of eliminated, controlled by 1955, 69 years ago. So, but the agency has been involved there for quite a while, with contacts throughout the region. The hatred of what started out as the Soviet Union and then has been transferred to Russia, and there's no justification for it. And people say, "Oh, you're a Putin apologist." Okay, yeah, I am. The Russians haven't invaded Iraq twice. The Russians have invaded Afghanistan only once, but then they left. The United States was forced out, forced to flee, abandoning people and personnel. The United States has been involved militarily in Somalia and Ethiopia. We're bombing Yemen. We're carrying out military operations in Syria and Iraq again. The one country that's been a pernicious influence in the world in terms of military adventurism ain't the Russians, United States.
He asked Bill Clinton if they were willing to let Russia into NATO. Clinton was willing to do that. He said, "Oh, no problem. That's a good idea to do that. And let's think about it." Suddenly he came back and said, "Oh, I talked with my team. They said, no, there is no possibility to do that." Who are these guys? Who are these people? Deep state, blob, whatever they
say. Yeah, so, what you wind up with is like the director of the CIA, deputy director of the CIA, Secretary of Defense, Assistant Secretary of Defense. You've got all these political appointees who are put into these administrations. And they're not always loyal to the president. They're loyal to the particular people that were their benefactors getting them on the inside. I know people like during the George W. Bush administration, you had Don Rumsfeld and then you had Paul Wolfowitz. I think Paul was his deputy. And, Paul is very much in the pocket of the Israeli government, very much a neoconservative, and would push, military involvement in areas where we probably shouldn't have been. So what Putin said last night, describing the conversation with Bill Clinton and then George W. Bush, underscores that although we have this perception that presidents are in charge and they're the ultimate decision makers, a lot of times they get sandbagged and circumvented by their subordinates. In fact, I have a friend who was the Assistant Secretary of State for one of the bureaus during George W. Bush. And my friend accompanied then Secretary of State Colin Powell to a meeting in the White House Situation Room. And there was George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, a secretary, as vice president, and Don Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense. What most people don't know is that Rumsfeld and Cheney had a relationship that went back to like 1968, 69. I know about that firsthand from a good friend of mine now deceased, who a fellow named Bruce Bradley. So Bruce was a Congressional Hill staffer. And in 1964, 65, he regularly played squash with another young congressman, a guy by the name of Donald Rumsfeld. So he and Rumsfeld were friends. Bruce went on to create a firm that was called Bradley Woods. It was a consulting firm. And in 1971, 72, he gets a call from Don Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld said, I got this young man. I need to get him a job. And so Bruce agreed to hire this young man who happened to be named Richard Cheney, Dick Cheney. So here are Rummy and Cheney at this meeting with George W. Bush. And they're talking about, well, the DEA taking steps to try to eradicate the poppies, the heroin poppies, because it was creating a real problem with drug trafficking. And Bush said, okay, yeah, that's what we're going to do. And then Cheney and Rumsfeld intervened and said, no. And they basically flipped the president's decision. So that's what the deep state is. People like that, that are, you know, in these bureaucracies. Most of them are not careerists. Most of them are, you know, political appointees, but have established relationships with several of the careerists as well, the people who have longtime careers in those agencies. So I think Putin in that interview really showed some insight into how the deep state works and how it's thwarted peace. Because if Russia would have been brought into NATO, the reason for NATO to exist would have disappeared. And then we wouldn't have to spend all that money on building up all these weapon systems to fight the imaginary enemy that Russia is supposed to be.
As I understand it, these people can act on one of these two parties, can be Republican or Democrat. At the same time, their mind is not belonging to any of these parties.
Yeah, you'll find it's the Green Party, okay? But I don't mean the environmentally correct. I mean the green one with the money. You know, the Benjamin Franklin Green Party. Those $100 bills. That's where this comes down. That the military, the military industrial corporations that benefit from all these government contracts. It's not just the military. It's the pharmaceutical industry. It's the agricultural industry. You've got, you know, the United States is passing out lots of money to some very large organizations, and, you know, including people like Elon Musk even. So, yeah, it's not about political affiliation as much as it is about the money.
Putin was talking about it as a serious moment in their relation with the United States. He mm-hmm. said that they were suggesting to have a unified missile defense system with the United States and Europe. If we were going to that direction, in your opinion, was it possible to have these kind of difficulties that we are dealing with right now?
Yeah, no, it would have been an earth game changer and made the earth a safer place. I recall very distinctly in going into January of 2001. So in November of 2000, like November 7th, Milt Bearden, another retired CIA officer, he'd actually run the Mujahideen support program in Afghanistan when the Soviets were there. He and I wrote a joint op-ed that appeared in the New York Times, saying that whoever the next president is, they're going to need to focus on two guys as far as terrorism is concerned. One was named Imad Mughniyeh, and the other was Osama bin Laden. So the Bush administration comes in. I know that Richard Clark, a national security advisor, had been an NSC advisor under Bill Clinton, had written an extensive memo about what needed to be done. And basically Condoleezza Rice, wiped her ass with it, threw it away, ignored it. Because what were they concerned about? Missile defense. They wanted to build missile defense. They were selling that, oh, we're going to be attacked by these terrorist groups or whoever. So we need to have Star Wars, missile defense. That was the theme throughout the year. And then they finally held, there was an interagency counterterrorism meeting that's supposed to take place every month, chaired by the National Security Council. But that meeting didn't happen until September 10th, 2001. And next day, 9/11 happened. And I know there are a lot of conspiracy theories out there, but I know for a fact that the Bush administration was focused up to that point and that moment on getting missile defense. And then the very next, you know, so this is 2001, and I think it was either that summer or the next summer that the Bush administration unilaterally withdrew from the anti-ballistic missile ABM treaty, broke it off with Russia. And the Russians were like, what are you doing? And the United States, ah, screw you, we're going to go our own way. Well, the United States got distracted with this so-called war on terrorism. And while we were distracted, the Russians went and built some of the most, the most effective air defense missiles, anti-ballistic missile defense systems in the world, hands down. United States is not even in the theater to compete. And people said, well, why is that important? Well, if you actually have a functional anti-ballistic missile defense system, that means you could potentially launch your ballistic missiles, hit the targets in the that you're shooting at, and still be able to fend off any missiles fired back at you because you have an effective anti-ballistic missile defense. So, simple thing.
Denazification. Putin just used this, and he was talking about that we didn't achieve our objectives in Ukraine because we need to denazify Ukraine. And when Tucker Carlson asked him, what does it mean? How you can get rid of these neo-Nazis, these ultra-nationalists in the western part of Ukraine? He said something so interesting. He said, we have to put it in the constitution of Ukraine that these people cannot act the way they were acting during all these years. What's your take on this?
Well, no, I think he did a pretty good job of trying to define what they're wanting to do. You start by tearing down the statues of Stepan Bandera and others that they are have elevated as heroes who conspired with, collaborated with the Nazis. You remove from educational material those, you know, you don't erase them from history, but you don't make them heroes in historical, in the history books. You really try to point out what they were and how they conducted themselves and what it meant to be a Nazi. That, you know, when you're talking about Nazis, what are you talking about? You're talking about someone who invests all power and authority in a particular personality, the National Socialist ideal, but that was embodied by Adolf Hitler, which is why there's sort of that cult of personality surrounding Hitler to this day. The concept of racial purity, as if there is such a thing. But people that advocate racial purity would fall into that category as, you know, that would be considered a criminal act to propose it or support that. You know, persecuting Jews by virtue of their religious nature, the same for gypsies, same for homosexuals. And that's one of the sort of the real ironies about this, that the original Nazis, on the one hand, were very anti-homosexual, and yet they were some of their biggest, the most influential officers were themselves homosexual, particularly in the early days of the organization. Ernst Röhm, from the Brown Shirts, was a notorious homosexual. So, you know, you run into these different beliefs that end up defining the neo-Nazi movement and why Russia wants to extirpate that from Ukraine.
It seems to me he was implicating that all those people who were clapping for this neo-Nazi, they were committing a criminal act.
Well, remember, what came before that comment by Putin was that, you know, Tucker said, yeah, why are you worried about Nazis? That Hitler died 80 years ago. It's actually 79 years ago, but, you know, who's counting? And Putin was like, really? 79 years ago, just last year, in Canada, you had the entire Canadian Parliament standing up, applauding and celebrating a Nazi, a bona fide member of the Schutzstaffel, the SS. So he said, no, we're not dealing with something that's old and out of date. We're dealing with something that's current and reality.
When Tucker Carlson was asking Putin, what's the problem with Russia and why Russia is the biggest enemy of the United States? He said that, no, in the eyes of the United States, China is the real enemy of the United States in terms of their population, in terms of their economy, in terms of the way they're growing. If that's the case, if the pure competitor of the United States is China, why they started the war with Russia in Ukraine?
The reason you do that, you got to take Russia out first. Because, you know, the U.S. policy has always been predicated on creating a division, a split between Russia and China, and best to create a conflict between them. So get Russia out of the way first. They're the easiest. They're the smallest. Huh. So supposedly. They just miscalculated. What they ended up doing is creating a stronger relationship between Russia and China, the strongest that's ever existed in the history of those two nations, going back 1,000 years. So, but that was why the United States was divide and conquer. Take out Russia first, then take out China.
He said before starting this war, he talked with Biden and he said, you're making a great mistake by the escalation of this conflict in Ukraine. He didn't mention what was the Biden's reaction. In your opinion, what was the Biden's reaction to that?
Well, we don't need to speculate. We just look at his response that Putin made very specific requests about withdrawing getting pledges not to proceed with NATO membership for Ukraine, withdrawing these missile bases that are now in Poland and in Romania that are targeting Russia. And all the United States had to do was say, okay, yeah, we can do that. And then we'll talk about how to come to agreements that will reassure each side that the other's not going to be an aggressor. Totally walked away from it. Basically told him to screw off. And then Russian intelligence picked up that the Ukrainians, with the help of the United States and the Brits, were mobilizing their forces because they were going to step up attacks in the Donbas to finish off the militias of Donetsk and Luhansk. That was the plan. And Putin's special military operation preempted that. And the Ukrainians were prepared to negotiate, and the Russians were willing to negotiate, even to make some significant concessions by the end of March of 2022. And the United States said, oh, hell no, that's not going forward. Got a hold of, you know, Secretary of Defense Austin, went over and told, you know, Zaluzhny, nope, this is not going to happen. Don't do it. Biden sent Boris Johnson over. Johnson said, don't do it. Oh, we promise we'll give you all the aid you need. You'll fight and beat those Russians. Fools. The Ukrainians are fools. They believed the Western promises, and they're paying a terrible price for having done so.
This fear coming from Russia that Russia is going to march toward Latvia, toward Poland, toward Europe. Germans are talking about preparing for decades of war with Russia. He said that it's not possible. We are not attacking anybody if they're not attacking us. Do you think that would bring some sort of sanity to Europe?
They're not paying attention to it. They're not listening. They didn't. I doubt they had any news coverage of it. I know that in the United States, they've given very, very scant mention of the interview. In fact, you know, I went on to both the websites for CNN, Fox News, MSNBC. Nothing, no story about the interview. There is this, you know, an offhand, backhanded story about Tucker Carlson asking Vladimir Putin to release Evan Gershkovitz, the Wall Street Journal reporter. But they don't say this was done in part of an extensive 2-hour interview. No, it's just that this request, it's like it came out of the blue. So Nobody in Europe, I'm sure, got a chance to hear it, unless they got on the internet. Now, it's worth noting that the numbers for that keep going off the charts. It was, about 2 hours ago, it was 130,000 or 130 million views. Now it just crossed, it's 150 million. So that's almost 50% of the size of the United States. It's enormous. And this is the English version. This is not like it's translated. You know, Carlson's, he's reaching beyond, in the United States and beyond.
The other thing that Putin talked about was the mercenaries who are in Ukraine, foreign mercenaries, Poland, United States, and the third place, Georgia. The way he was talking about this, it should be a lot of mercenaries in Ukraine. We didn't know about that. What's your take on this?
Well, yeah, I found that really fascinating that he laid out. I would not have predicted that the U.S. had the second largest mercenary presence, but I believe Putin knows what he's talking about. Think back 3 weeks ago, was it 3-4 weeks ago, when that French group of mercenaries in a hotel in Kharkiv were bombed, killed. That was a lot of, over 60. There were reportedly as many as 200 mercenaries in there. So if France is, in fourth, fifth, sixth place, it's telling you how large the Polish contingent is, the U.S. contingent, and the Georgian contingent. Probably more, well in excess of 200 people, for sure.
Finally, Zelensky got rid of Zeluzhny, and the new guy coming along, I don't know, Sursky?
Sursky.
Victoria Nuland was there. Did she try to calm down the situation and try to solve it as soft as possible?
I think she was largely ignored. I know some things that she came in to make the deal. But remember, the sequence on this was it a week ago Monday, so almost, 12 days ago. Zelensky met with Zeluzhny and said, okay, I want your resignation. Zeluzhny gave him a gesture with the middle finger, and basically said, hey, bafangu, and walked out. So Nuland shows up, and after Nuland shows up, the reports, oh, Zeluzhny's gone on Friday. He'll be resigning. Oh, he may be going as the ambassador to Britain. Friday came and went, nothing. Last Saturday, oh, he's going today, guaranteed. Didn't go. So then every day there's these rumors back and forth. Zeluzhny's publishing articles that are critical of Ukraine's efforts in the Donbas. I guess that comes out like Tuesday. So Thursday night at 8 o'clock, it's then that Zelensky announces, oh, Zeluzhny's gone. He's out of here. Oof, we're replacing him with Sursky. Now, the fact that they did it after hours is always indicative of they're trying to keep it low key, downplay it. But we do know that Zeluzhny is close with Peter Poroshenko, and that, former presidential candidate, and with Vitaly Klitschko, the mayor of Kiev, who both oppose Zelensky. So Zelensky's in some political trouble because now he's put the army under the control of Sursky, that many of the army commanders and officers hate. They despise him. They see him as a killer, but he's not good at killing Russians. He's good at getting Ukrainians killed. So that remains to be seen if the guys down the food chain are going to follow his orders. And then you have Zelensky at the same time saying, oh, we're going to have this massive shakeup. We're going to get rid of a lot of these officers and replace them. And you're going, replace them with what? It's not like they got a military school stocked with new colonels, new lieutenant colonels standing by, ready to jump in and take charge. No, doesn't exist. They've got tremendous manpower shortages to the point that there was a recent report that you had a young lieutenant. Understand that lieutenants are like the bottom of the barrel. That's your starting job in the military as an officer. This lieutenant was in charge of a battalion. A battalion's usually under the control of a colonel. So you go from lieutenant to captain to major to lieutenant colonel to colonel. So you got 4 or 5 steps to move up. And that takes 20 years or more. And yet you got a young captain, young lieutenant commanding a battalion. Recipe for disaster. And it has been a disaster for Ukraine. So they don't have this cadre of senior officers. And then with this political chaos unfolding in Kiev, that it has a tendency to freeze initiatives on the battlefront. So across the board, this is a disaster, big mess.
For a country that is in a serious war like Ukraine, when you go there and you want to find a solution like what we've seen between Zelensky and Zaluzhny, you mainly will be in favor of the head of military because they're doing the job right now. When you look at the way they were dealing with this conflict between Zelensky and Zaluzhny, and they finally decided that Zelensky would be a better choice for them than Zaluzhny, what was the reason behind this decision? Because Zelensky was more obedient, in your opinion?
Well, no, I don't know who's making the decisions here. That's the point. It's like the same problem we have with the United States. Who's in charge? Is it Joe Biden? No, but who is it? So you've got, you know, they've been sending conflicting messages for quite a while. More than a year ago, when the battle in Bakhmut was raging, it was reported that Zaluzhny, the general, wanted to withdraw Ukrainian forces because he thought that they were needlessly being slaughtered, that they didn't need to die in such numbers. Who blocked him? Zelensky, reportedly. So Zelensky exerted control at that point over what the military would do. And maybe, you know, Zaluzhny's point then was to say, I'll give him enough rope to hang himself. And, you know, that's continued through today. So that Zaluzhny was the one who wanted to pull people out of Bakhmut to save their lives, not Zelensky. Zelensky wanted to stay and fight. And it was Sursky who was carrying out Zelensky's orders to that effect. Same thing is now going on in Avdiivka, where the common sense says that the Ukrainian troops should pull out, fall back, take up new defensive positions. Zelensky's insisting they stand and fight, protect the coke plant. I guess he apparently believes that plant makes actually cocaine without realizing it's a steel factory. But you know, they're going to keep him in there. So it really, they're saying that they're firing Zaluzhny for failure to be a good commander. Yet the one that keeps overriding his commands is Zelensky. So, you know, Zelensky's going to ultimately think, I think, pay a big price for this. Because this decision is not popular among the people. And they've already had protesters started showing up in the Maidan Square, a small contingent right now. But if that grows, if that numbers increase, then it's going to be the hunt for a successor will be on. Let's put it that way.
With the situation that we're witnessing right now in Avdiivka, as you've mentioned, do you think Odessa and Nikolaev are still on the table to be saved for Ukrainians?
The only possible chance will be if Ukraine decides to enter into negotiations with Russia and says, okay, we will recognize all of this territory east of the Dnieper as belonging to Russia, with the exception of Odessa and Kherson. You know, some deal like that. But And I don't see the Russians going for it. I think that they've reached the point where they realize Ukraine's not going to give up till they're dead. So they're going to accommodate them, make them dead.
One of the things that I found it so fascinating about this interview, when he was asking Putin about BRICS and G7, this mm-hmm. confrontation of two powers, Putin responded that it's just like a human brain. It has two parts that should work together instead of fighting each right. other.
Yeah, I think you're going to have first the defeat of Ukraine and Ukraine surrendering. And then related to that, people in Germany, France, come to their senses and try to reestablish relations with Moscow. I think rebuilding relations with the United States is going to take a lot more time. But then again, the United States is so distracted now with the war in Yemen and Gaza and Syria and Iraq, that they're not going to have as much time to pay attention to Ukraine. It'll be on the back burner. Not really, because if nothing else, you don't have a lot of Ukrainian financial donors that are kicking money into the campaign coffers of members of Congress. In contrast with the Israelis, they got a lot of money to throw around, and they have a lot of supporters who will give money to members of Congress that are actively and overtly supporting Israel.
He said that China's foreign policy is not about aggression. It's right. all about seeking compromise and cooperation. At the end of the day, with these problems that you're witnessing in Ukraine, in Gaza, do you see any hope in the United States, in these politicians who are deciding about everything, that they would change their mind to have some sort of cooperation, compromise yeah. with China no. and Russia?
No. There's no room for compromise here. This is the United States has a necessity to maintain these conflicts going because it provides money, guaranteed money going into these military industrial corporations. And those corporations in turn fund congressional campaigns. And that money that's being pumped into these let's call them isolated segments of the U.S. economy are seen as critical for generating economic growth. So no, they're not going to compromise at all. The only thing that will bring it into this is a defeat, a military defeat. And you're going to wind up with more dead U.S. military personnel, I guarantee it, if they continue to do what they're doing in Ukraine and in Israel.
Larry, if you were to summarize this interview with Putin, what would be the picture that you would draw out of this interview?
You saw somebody who was relaxed and in command. You know, I think we talked about it earlier, where just his body language alone sits back in the chair, not quite slumped, but just very relaxed, arms open by his side on the armrests, legs, knees apart, no cross legs. He wasn't sitting there like this. He's sitting there like this. So he's open. Now that's, I'll call that an intel trick. I know that intelligence officers are taught to how to, you know, when you meet with somebody to try to mirror how they're sitting, or you can sit in a particular way in order to force them without knowing it, that they'll start following your lead and look like you. So that's one way to make people feel relaxed and as an open encounter. So, you know, that was the first thing I noticed about him. The second was his ability to speak extemporaneously without notes. But this really, that wasn't a surprise because you've seen them do that over and over and over and over and over and over. As long as he's been on the world stage. He just did two months ago, a 4-hour press conference and took questions from all over the world. He showed, you know, a good ability to speak on his feet, you know, think quickly. And some of the, Tucker was not trying to play gotcha, but he was trying to ask some, you know, pretty tough questions that could have tripped someone of lesser skill and ability up. So I thought Putin was quite effective in that regard, and he was trying to talk to the West. Unfortunately, much of the mainstream media in the West has done their best to turn him off, shut him out, and not listen to him.
He said that he doesn't understand what's going on in Germany. They're sacrificing everything. Is that understandable, in your opinion, what they're doing to their country?
Yeah, they're fanatics. They're ideologues. They're as bad as the Nazis in terms of their buying into this global, this climate change nonsense, and using that as justification for eliminating natural gas. So in the process, they've raised energy costs off the charts, forcing factories and businesses to shut down. And they're happy to have those shut down. That way, people aren't driving those damn cars to work. They're not buying the gasoline. It's going to dry up demand. And, hey, next thing you know, everybody will be living in wood huts and doing caveman commercials. It's absurd. But it looks like the Germans, now that they're starting to suffer the pain, are starting to awaken to this and go, wait a second. Well, we don't want to go down this road. But I don't know if it's too late to rescue them or not. We'll see.